Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Here's a question that needs pondering right now. What if Batman captures the Joker and the Joker confesses to a crime? Could his attorneys later have the confession thrown out because he never was given a Miranda warning? Or consider this, could Batman patent the Batmobile? Or does the Second Amendment apply to Wolverine's claws? These time-stopping questions are the subject of a new book, The Law of Superheroes, written by a pair of attorneys, and we'll get to it right now. Later on this hour, the 2013 job outlook and the new jobless figures out this morning. But first up, it's a bird, it's a plane, it's a lawsuit waiting to happen, and the new book, The Law of Superheroes. The book's authors join us now, James Daly from St. Louis. James, good morning. Nice to have you.
Thank you.
And Ryan Davidson from Fort Wayne, Indiana. Ryan, good morning to you, too.
Good to be here.
Well, James, let's dive right into this. What if one superhero kills another, but that deceased superhero springs back from the dead? Could that first superhero still be charged with murder, or where are we with this?
Well, I think there are a couple of possibilities. It's something that hasn't really come up a lot, even in. even in cases where somebody is thought to be deceased, you know, they've gone missing, presumed dead, that kind of thing. Yeah. They very rarely actually turn back up, and from what we can tell, there might be some interesting, like, consequences with regard to inheritance and insurance payouts and that kind of thing. But we think that they would probably be still considered to have committed murder, because I think there's a very strong public policy against killing people, and I don't think we would want to encourage people to play the odds that, oh well, maybe my victim will come back to life. But even if the courts decided, well, no, they strictly speaking didn't die because of the technical definition of death, so it wasn't murder. It would still be, of course, attempted murder, and that's still a pretty serious crime.
You know, Ryan, where did you guys come up with all these very, very important questions?
Well, the idea for the blog came from James at a dinner discussion, and he can talk about that in a minute. As we keep going through writing the blog and then writing the book, some of that comes from our own consumption of media. We read comic books, we watch movies, we watch TV shows, but a lot of it comes from interactions with fans and readers. I mean, there's only so many books and shows that we can watch in a given week. But here we have, thousands of people that are reading these things and coming up with questions, and that's been a really, really productive source of material for us.
And the blog you're talking about, James, is what?
Lawandthemultiverse.com.
And tell us how that thing got started. How did you guys get it going?
Well, as Ryan mentioned, it came about with a dinner conversation with my wife and a couple of friends of ours, and the topic came around to Superman's X-ray vision, his ability to see through walls and other things. And we got to thinking, if a lot of people in a society, like if there were a lot of people like Superman in society, had X-ray vision, then privacy law would probably have to be a lot different, because people would have, the idea of a reasonable expectation of privacy would be very different if everybody could see through walls. And a friend of ours said, you should start a blog about that kind of thing, and he would read it, and that'd be at least one person. And I thought, I'm going to start this blog, and be like most things, I'll write a couple of posts, I'll lose interest, and that'll be that. But it's taken off, and we've been very pleasantly surprised by the response.
Ryan, and why do you think it took off? What is it going on in society that people are still so interested in superheroes and how they live their lives and what it all means?
Well, I think there's probably two answers to that question. The first is sort of more narrow. How did this specific blog sort of take off really quickly? And there we have to give a lot of credit to the Metafilter community. That is how James and I met. It's a website where members can post links, and there's a subsite where they can post their own projects. So James posted that there. I saw it right away. And a lot of people read Metafilter, so this got media exposure very, very quickly. As to why people in general are interested about these issues, I think a couple of reasons. One thing is that, depending on what you think about it, comic books are big right now. Mm-hmm. Avengers was an enormous movie. The Dark Knight has had three huge hits there. The Avengers movies continue. There's going to be, I think, Iron Man and Thor come out next year. We're looking at Avengers 2 and a few more years after that. This is an enormous media presence, and people like thinking about it, especially comic book fans. These are alternative worlds, getting into the details of who these people are, who they know, what they've done, what they can do. This is something people spend time on. And so when we come along and say, hey, look, we can actually provide a little bit of expert insight into the details of some of these transactions, people are interested in that.
James, I gather that superheroes and comic books, they've always been big, haven't they?
Yeah, always. Going back to about the late 1930s when Superman really got started with Action Comics, they've had a pretty long history. And that's one of the great things about comics is because they've been around for so long and because there have been so many dozens of writers and illustrators coming up with these stories, there's such an enormous wealth of material. It's not like a single movie where it's kind of difficult to come up with good factual scenarios to talk about different legal illegal issues. Almost every legal issue you can think of has at some point either directly or indirectly been involved in a comic book story.
You know, I gather, James, this book was intended to be a lot of fun, and I'm wondering how you guys got together and kicked around ideas for the different kinds of legal issues you wanted to address in the law of superheroes.
Well, we did it a couple of ways. Usually what happens is we'll read a comic book and we'll think, we'll look at it critically. We'll think, what are the legal issues here? As a lawyer, what do I see? And then we'll come up with ideas from that. And then sometimes we think the other direction. We think, let's think about contract law. Where do we see contracts in comics? And so then we'll go research it and we'll find some contracts that have happened in comics. And contracts with the devil are actually one of the more common kinds in comic books, which is its own interesting area. And so what we did with the book is we use those two approaches to come up with each chapter is generally dedicated to a specific area of the law, so constitutional law or contracts or what have you. And so and that's basically how we did it. We organized it by chapters, and then we kicked it back and forth until we built up a pretty good size number of cases.
But if, Ryan, if you're looking at it that way, you're looking at a comic book for its legal ramifications, doesn't that take the fun out of the whole thing for you?
Oh, not at all. Two reasons there. One, people read these books because they like thinking about them. And thinking about it this way doesn't really change all that much. But beyond that, we don't know whether it's a testament to the sensibility of our legal system or the skill of comic book authors, but we've actually found that more often than not, things are handled, if not strictly accurately, at least plausibly. Mm-hmm. So even if they don't explain it correctly, the result is frequently right.
And that makes it a whole lot of fun to talk about then.
Right. It isn't like we're constantly picking things apart. You did this wrong, you did that wrong. It's like, no, this could work. It might have to happen this way, but yeah, that's going to work.
Well, let's see what questions our listeners have about the law and superheroes. Maybe they've had questions that have popped up even in the course of this conversation. If you have one, give us a shout. 816-235-2888 is our phone number. Our email address, updatedate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. James, I gather you two are obviously big fans of the comics and of graphic novels, for that matter. Tell us about that and sort of where you got your start, James, and what you read these days.
My first comic books that I can remember reading was when I was about 9 or 10 were the Superman and Batman stories that have become pretty famous. The Death of Superman series was about that time, and also the Batman Nightfall series, which involved the supervillain Bane, who's the villain in the most recent Batman movie, and was an inspiration in that case. And so those were a couple of the first stories I read when I was about 9 or 10. I guess those would have been in the early 90s. And that's where I got my start. And these days I read Daredevil, which is a great one for an attorney because Daredevil's secret identity, Matt Murdock, is an attorney. And so there are a lot of great courtroom scenes and things like that. It's very nice to read. And the author, has done a really great job of handling the legal issues. And it's really one of the best comic books going around these days. So that's one of the big ones that I follow right now.
What powers, I'm not familiar with Daredevil. What powers, James, does Daredevil have?
He was blinded at an early age, and so he developed the rest of his senses became sort of superpowered to compensate. So there's an incredible hearing and sense of touch and that kind of thing. So, for example, he can hear somebody's heartbeat and breath from across the room and can tell if somebody's lying. It's a great ability for a lawyer.
Ryan, tell us about your own love of graphic novels. Where did that come from?
Well, I didn't read a lot of comic books as a kid, but I've been reading sort of science fiction and fantasy speculative fiction since as long as I can remember. It wasn't really in college that I started getting more into comic books and graphic novels. These days, I'm actually reading a lot of independent comics. There's one called The Uniques, which is very interesting. It's by a married couple up in Michigan.
The Uniques?
The Uniques,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
They try and take seriously the idea that if people with superpowers appeared in society, that's actually going to make a huge difference. Laws are going to have to change. The way people think about things are going to have to change. Someone doesn't just suddenly show up with telepathy and people just go about their business. That's going to matter. And they really try and say, okay, what is society going to look like with these people wandering around? Another one I've been looking at is called The Secret History. This is actually a French comic that's been translated and put out by Arkea. The idea is that there are these sort of ancient group of siblings that are behind a lot of world events. And thus far, they've traced it up through the end of World War II.
Hmm. Again, our phone number here, 816-235-2888. We're talking about the law and our superheroes. I'm just wondering, let's go back to that first example we talked about a superhero kills another, but the deceased superhero comes back from the dead. What if the killer superhero is sentenced to life in prison and we'll assume this superhero is immortal? Would that be considered then, being sentenced to life in prison, would that be considered cruel and unusual punishment, James?
Probably, but I think it wouldn't come up until the person had been in prison for a long time, because when someone is sentenced to life in prison right now, that means something like 60 to 80 years tops,
yeah, right.
as a practical matter. And we've decided that that's not cruel and unusual. So I think that they could possibly bring a suit for release, but it wouldn't happen until they'd been in prison for at least 60 or 80 years, because up until that point, that's pretty normal kind of punishment. So I think it's possible that they could contest that, but I think they would have to wait a long time before they could get their day in court.
Ryan, do we have convicted killers who are in prison for 60, 65, 70 years and then suddenly turn to a judge and say, okay, that's long enough, anything longer would be considered cruel and unusual?
Not really. Most states contemplate a sentence which is called life without the possibility of parole. If that sentence is handed down, the person goes to jail and they never come out, and that's the end of it. And that is constitutional.
Hmm. Another question you raise in this book, The Law of Superheroes, there's this one. Does the Second Amendment, which gives us the right to bear arms, obviously, and has been so much in the news lately, does that apply to the Wolverine's clause?
It may. The Second Amendment, there's been a couple of recent cases a couple of years ago, D.C. v. Heller and McDonald v. Chicago. And in those cases, the Supreme Court took a fairly expansive view of the Second Amendment, holding in particular that bans on handguns were unconstitutional as they were done in those cases. And it's quite possible that they would be considered weapons. The interesting thing, of course, is that if they were tried to be regulated, something like his claws, the problem is he can't remove them, and so they're a permanent part of his body, especially because of the adamantium skeleton. I mean, they couldn't be removed even if you wanted to. There's practically no force on earth that could do so. And so, in those cases, I think we'd fall back on some cases that have held that you can't punish somebody for merely existing in a particular state. In particular, there was a case involving criminalizing the state of being addicted to drugs, basically, not possessing drugs or taking drugs or selling drugs, but simply being an addict. And the court held that you can't criminalize that, simply existing in a particular way. And so I think what would happen if there was a regulation, for example, with regard to concealed weapons, I think we would say, well, we can't punish him for merely having them, but if he uses them in an illegal way, then that could be punished.
Hmm. Ryan, you guys mentioned a few minutes ago this whole notion of Superman having X-ray vision. Would that be considered an invasion of privacy these days?
These days, it probably would. There's actually sort of two cases that come into play here. One of them is an older Supreme Court case where the court was addressing telephones for the first time, and one of the justices made sort of an offhand comment about, look, how far are we going to take this? If we develop the ability to read people's minds, does the mere fact that we can do that mean that people no longer have an expectation of privacy there? Well, probably not. So the mere fact that Superman has X-ray vision is not in and of itself going to automatically mean he can use it anywhere he wants to. That would have to become a very, very common technology that people are used to having around. More on point, though, we're not talking about the Fourth Amendment protection against unreasonable search and seizure.
Mm-hmm.
And the Supreme Court has said, okay, the cops can drive by your house, and if they're just driving by and they see you doing something illegal or they see that pot plant in your front window, they can come in and do something about that. They don't even necessarily need a warrant. If they see a crime happening, they can intervene. What they can't do is sit outside with an infrared camera and try and detect the lights from your grow op. That's too much. That's invading the sanctity of your home, invading your right of privacy. Similarly, they're not allowed to, like, fly over with a plane. Now, that's too much. So, you know, what people can see by just general inspection, there's no right to privacy in that. But if you're really starting to get inside what people are doing in the privacy of their homes, like with X-ray vision, that's probably not okay.
Well, it all wouldn't matter anyway. It's kind of a moot point because you really couldn't imprison Superman because he could always break out, right?
Well,
yes.
Yeah.
Well, that's true. But his personal sense of morals and ethics has led to a couple of cases in which he's been, as it turns out, wrongly accused of crimes. But he's nonetheless dutifully reported to prison and stayed there, knowing that he could break out whenever he wanted to, just because he had, you know, faith in the American justice system.
I can tell you guys had a whole lot of fun with this book, The Law of Superheroes. Let's go to some phone calls. 816-235-2888 is our phone number. We're talking about superheroes and how the law applies would apply to them. Let's go to Joe from Kansas City, Missouri. Joe, good morning.
Good morning. I was wondering if you guys could speak to the international ramifications of this. I know superheroes don't just exist in America. I mean, they go around the world doing things. How would the laws apply there? Would it be like the laws of war and the rules of engagement type thing, or what do you think?
International borders, James, what do you think?
Well, the caller mentioned war, and I think that the answer there is in most cases superheroes are kind of acting on their own, and so the law of war, the Geneva Convention, that kind of thing probably wouldn't apply to them because they're not part of a nation's military. Now, in some cases they are, and in that case that would be a complication. And you mentioned borders. It's true. You don't see a lot of superheroes stopping at customs to, you know, declare any weapons they may be bringing into a country or whatever. They just kind of show up. And that's probably a big issue. And the comics have touched on that. In one comic, Superman was awarded honorary citizenship by every country in the United Nations. And maybe perhaps with all that came some special passport or something. It's an issue that is a big one, and the comic books mostly kind of gloss over it.
Joe, I hope that helps.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks. Brendan writes us on Facebook, did your guests ever see the movie The Incredibles, a great kids movie that dealt with exactly what you guys are talking about?
We have seen that, and we've written about it. One of the issues that comes up at the very beginning of the movie is that Mr. Incredible stops someone from committing suicide. The person's trying to jump off of a building, and the person sues them for an injury allegedly sustained during the rescue. And those kinds of lawsuits end up causing the superheroes to have to stop being superheroes. The government sort of gets tired of paying their legal bills and has them stop doing what they're doing. But actually, our research suggests that there wouldn't be a case there. That stopping a suicide is usually legally allowed, even if you have to, you know, restrain the person until the authorities can arrive. And in fact, in a couple of states, it is arguable that attempted suicide is actually still a crime, and in which case there's the additional privilege of not just stopping preventing a suicide, but preventing a crime.
Ryan, Rudy asks us this question. If the situation presented in the X-Men movies with laws being passed to segregate mutants is a realistic take on how our legal system might deal with superheroes, what about it?
Yeah, this gets to what's actually a fairly common theme in superhero stories, the concept of registration. In Watchmen, we had the Keene Act, where Congress gets together and bans, quote, costumed adventuring, unquote. In this world, we had a situation where there's only really one person with superpowers as such. There's a lot of people going around dressing up in costumes and doing stuff. And Congress eventually says, no, you're not allowed to do that. In D.C., in the D.C. universe, there's the sort of fictional 12th Amendment, unquote. Here it's something pretty mundane. In the D.C. universe, it has to do with the registration of superheroes with the federal government. In the Marvel universe, we had the Superhero Registration Act, which led to an event in that universe called the Civil War, ran for about a year in 2006. Registration is usually perceived in the Marvel universe as being a bad idea. In the DC universe, it seems to be more of a fact of life that doesn't really get commented on very often. But in a lot of these things, we're talking about the tension between the need for public safety and government control of the use of serious powers against individual liberty and freedom. And depending upon how Congress wants to implement that, there's more and less successful ways of doing that. The Commerce Clause might work, depending upon what they wanted to do, but in the Marvel Universe in particular, the Superhero Registration Act included some kind of force staffed by superheroes that worked for the government, and it wasn't quite clear whether every superhero had to register and then had to work for the government. Commerce Clause probably doesn't give them the power to do that, but the draft power might.
You know, thank goodness you guys think about issues like this. This is just good for us to have. I really like this issue that you raise in the book. What's Superman's tax liability every time he squeezes a piece of coal into a diamond, James?
Well, in that case, he doesn't have any tax liability just for the act of squeezing coal into a diamond, no more than, say, a painter does when he or she turns, you know, and paint into a million-dollar masterpiece. Simply creating the finished product, it doesn't create any is not income for tax purposes, I should say. However, if Superman sold it, then of course that would be income. And if he gave it away, then there would be potentially what was called a gift tax. Now, gift tax is something that most people don't worry about because we usually, you know, on Christmas and birthdays and that kind of thing, we don't give valuable enough gifts. There's significant exemptions and exclusions so that most of the time it's not a problem. But if you give somebody something really valuable, you can potentially end up owing a tax on it. It's possible for the recipient to pay the tax, but usually, of course, we have the giver pay the tax because, of course, they're the one with all the money, right? Otherwise, they wouldn't be giving the gift. But there's a nice loophole for Superman. If he gave somebody a worthless lump of coal, no gift tax because it's not worth very much, and then after giving them the coal, squeezed it into a diamond as a gratuitous service, then that wouldn't be taxed. There would be no gift tax. There wouldn't be any tax issues because free services are not taxed. Now, the downside of that is that you also can't claim a tax deduction for doing something for somebody for free, for like a charity, for example. But in that case, it would work out very well for Superman. For most people, it's not a big loophole because most people can't turn something worthless into something extremely valuable in just a couple of seconds. But for Superman, it could be a pretty nice tax loophole.
Well, you assume Superman doesn't pay taxes himself, though. The issue might become, James, if Clark Kent would have to pay those taxes and whether he could afford to pay them on a journalist's salary or not.
I think that it's important that they're the same person, and Clark Kent really should claim any income that Superman earns because they're the same person. And the comics have touched on this. In one case, Superman indicated that he gives all of any rewards, for example, that he earns for nabbing bad guys, he gives it all to charity. He claims that means that he wouldn't have to pay any taxes on it because it's not his income. He doesn't actually ever receive the money. So there are ways around that kind of thing.
Let's go to one more phone call here. John from Overland Park. John, you're on Up to Date with James Daly and Ryan Davidson, author of The Law of Superheroes. Good morning.
Good morning. I was just wondering if they had ever looked at the legal aspects of superhero television shows like Smallville.
I actually wrote a 4 or 5 post series on that, and I'm currently going through Arrow.
Going through what, please?
Yeah, Arrow, which is on the CW.
Oh, okay.
Explain that to me. You just lost me there, Ryan.
Oh, yeah. For about 10 years, there was a show on CW called Smallville, which has to do with Clark Kent growing up in this small town. I wrote 4 or 5 posts in the blog about that. I can't remember off the top of my head whether any of those examples show up in the book. I think they might. And then just now the CW is showing a TV show called Arrow, which is about Oliver Queen becoming Green Arrow. And I think I've written 3 or 4 posts on that and looking to do some more in the next 2 months.
Hmm. John, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Hey, just real quickly, James, what do your fellow lawyers say about this book and what you guys did here?
Oh, well, we've gotten some great feedback from lawyers, law students, law professors, and various people involved in the legal community over the years, both about the blog and about the book. We've gotten some, you know, great reviews and things. People seem very supportive of it and really enjoy it.
Okay, well, James and James Daly, Ryan Davidson, thanks so much for taking some time with us. Good to have you both today.
Thank you
very much.
You bet. Their new book, again, is The Law of Superheroes. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll visit with the Star's Diane Stafford about the latest unemployment numbers out this morning, and we'll also talk about the 2013 job outlook. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR.